ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's like walking on eggshells politically, you know, the sensitivities on both sides of this thing and the ability to strike the right balance. You're never going to please either side.
My government is concerned with the fight against inflation. Peter Dutton's concerned about fighting culture wars.
And I think if the Prime Minister wants to renege on an election commitment he's taken to the last two elections, I think he should call an election.
The housing system is cooked in this country.
And I was praying that the Minister and the government would finally wake up to themselves and do the right thing.
Hello there and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvallis from RN Breakfast and Q&A, joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly, host of Saturday Extra, joining you from the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And PK, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi has been in Canberra. He's the highest ranked Chinese official to visit Australia in 7 years. That ensured a pretty sharp focus on the meeting between he and Foreign Minister Penny Wong. Relations with China have been improving, it's fair to say, since the Albanese government took office. But there are still plenty of points of tension. Chief amongst them, the death sentence handed down to academic and writer Yang Heng Jun and the continuing trade bans slapped on our wine, our beef, our lobster sectors. Then there's the strategic tensions. China is a vehement critic of AUKUS. Australia's an outspoken critic of China's offensive posturing in the South China Sea. So plenty to talk about, as Penny Wong signalled on the way into that meeting.
You and I also agreed on the importance of dialogue between our two countries, not just to take forward our shared interests, but also to exchange views on the issues that matter to us and to navigate wisely any differences we have. With that in mind, I look forward to speaking frankly with you about Australians detained in China, human rights, maritime security and safety, as well as regional and international issues such as the Pacific, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the conflict in the Middle East.
That was Penny Wong as she sat with her Chinese counterpart going into the talks. After the meeting, PK, Penny Wong stood alone to take questions. That's notable in itself. She described the talks as a frank exchange. She told the Chinese Foreign Minister that Australians were shocked at the sentence handed out to Australian author Yang Heng Jun. But on all fronts, PK, and not unusually, I guess, no tangible results from this exchange yet. And still some troubling signs of China determined to do things its way and throw its weight around.
Yeah, Fran, as you mentioned, the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi refused to appear at a press conference in Canberra alongside Penny Wong. Now, just for those listeners who are not across, you know, these kind of meetings, you have a meeting usually and then the two leaders will stand next to each other with flags on both sides and they'll take a certain amount of questions from the Australian press and then the you know, press of the other country. But it's just showing what a different kind of place this is. That didn't happen. So, you know,
They refused. They were asked many times, I gather, and they refused to do it.
They wouldn't. There's the meeting with the former Prime Minister, Paul Keating, too, which has really been a disruptor in all of this, at the Chinese Foreign Minister's request. And given Paul Keating has been extremely critical of the government's approach on China, on AUKUS and its relationship with the United States, and on Senator Wong herself, I mean, he has been almost her fiercest critic, and it's got quite personal at times. And he knew that taking this meeting would cause problems.
I think it's exactly made Penny Wong's life very easy. No, I think it's interesting that you make the point that he knew this would cause problems for Labor when he said yes, but China knew it would cause problems for the Australian government when they asked for this meeting too, don't you reckon?
There's no chance that they would have not known that this would have been awkward, hashtag awkward, and yet they did. Either way, the thawing of this relationship is in both countries' best interests. Phil Currie from the Australian Financial Review will join us soon to talk a bit more about it. It has been significant and I think an important step.
Yeah, and PK, another major concern for Labor this week has been the ongoing fallout from the Israel-Gaza conflict here at home. On Friday, the government announced it would restore funding to the UN Aid Agency for Palestinians, or UNRWA, as it's known. It's the primary agency that distributes aid across Gaza and has done for many years. Our government had joined several other Western nations in freezing funding for UNRWA following allegations made by Israeli intelligence that some UNRWA employees had been directly involved, directly linked to the October the 7th Hamas attacks on Israel. Foreign Minister Penny Wong now says that the best available advice shows, and I quote, UNRWA is not a terrorist organisation and that existing additional safeguards sufficiently protect Australian taxpayer funding, end of quote. But PK, this decision for Australia to restore that promised, I think it was $6 million, has not been without its critics.
Oh, absolutely not. The opposition was quick to decry the government's decision to unpause. Here's the Shadow Home Affairs Minister, James Patterson.
My view is that we should not tolerate a single Australian dollar going to a potential terrorist.
A strong and immediate rejection of the government's decision from the opposition, even as the UN again this week reported that famine is imminent in Gaza, that aid is critical. But Fran, there are a lot of critics internally in the government about the way the government has handled this and also the visas for Gazans coming to Australia, that there was the quick response to pause the funding and now they've restored it when there hasn't even been the investigation finished. They've looked like they've kind of bungled some of this or that they have been too reactive to the allegations by Israel and then too reactive to the criticisms. You can see that they're trying to navigate some red hot feelings, really, in the community about this issue, and it's done them some damage internally.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about it before that Labor is really copping it over its foreign policy response to the war in Gaza. The voters in heavily Muslim-populated electorates have turned against them, according to the polls. At the same time, Jewish Australians aren't happy either. It's a minefield. The opposition knows that. You mentioned the visa issue, just to bring people up to speed. The Australian government was quite speedy in issuing more than 2,000 visas to people in Gaza to come to a safe haven in Australia, basically. That's the backstory to this extraordinary thing that occurred this week when last week, to this extraordinary thing that happened last week, PK, when several people fleeing Gaza with an Australian visa in their pocket were stopped mid-journey and turned around. They were actually on the plane and then they were told they could no longer come to Australia, so they were stranded in Turkey and Egypt and other places. No visas, no money, no support. It was an absolutely cruel mess. The government's now reversed some of those visa cancellations, not all of them, but some of them. PK, what was this about? Was it about security concerns? Were they just spooked by the opposition criticism, as you implied there? And whose decision was this?
All great questions and no definitive answers because the process has been opaque and they haven't been transparent about all of it. They said that essentially, the reporting was that they were concerned that these people would stay permanently. Now, that's different to a security concern, right? And then there were some reports that clearly there were some security concerns about some people, and yet they were offered the visas initially. And so there are some reasonable questions to ask about how did they get the visa if then the security concerns came up later. Now, the opposition's central charge is that it's because they're in a rush.
Yeah, they rushed this. They rushed national security.
And by pausing, they actually fed into that, didn't they? I mean,
it looked like they were spooked by that opposition attack, didn't it?
It looked like it, and I believe that in some cases, because every individual case is different, to be clear, like it's really complex, this system, but that they were, that they were spooked. They know, just look at the immigration detention issues that they're dealing with at the moment, that they can't have this go off the rails for them. They have to be pretty sure, right? But at the same time, in the community, there are diaspora members of the community who have sponsored these people to come, who are waiting for them, who felt really, really disturbed about the way it was handled. And so then a reversal on some of these individuals that made it look very messy. At the same time, then changing the position back on UNRWA. All of this, I think, has been handled in a way that has been problematic for the government.
I think the UNRWA decision is a bit different because we acted as other governments acted as well and then reversed almost in tandem with other governments. But this messiness, as you say, over the handling of the visas with no real clear or good explanation to the Australian people about it, you know, it follows, as we've talked before on the podcast, about the messiness around that High Court decision that saw the release of all those detainee people who were detained. That was very messy in the government's account. account of it and their managing of it, and that still goes on. It's this messiness that I think is causing them problems. The opposition can see it. I'm not sure if the problem is with government or is with the Department of Home Affairs, which seems to be involved in both cases, but something is wrong.
There shouldn't be a distinction, though, right? Under the Westminster
system.
That's true.
There's not.
The buck stops with the minister.
That's right.
And so the Minister for Home Affairs is Claire O'Neill. Now, obviously, the Immigration Minister, Andrew Giles, has a role too, and he's obviously been under sustained attack from the opposition. But Claire O'Neill is the senior minister responsible. We're going to see this issue not go away for the government, and I don't think we're getting a lot of transparency on how these decisions are being made.
And on that note, I think we should bring in our guest. What do you think?
Let's do it. Phil Curry is the political editor of the Australian Financial Review, friend of the podcast. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Patricia. Friend.
Hey, Phil, great to have you back. Phil, PK and I have just been talking about some foreign issues that have been around this week, front and centre, but a very domestic issue arose out of the blue too. The Prime Minister announcing he will not proceed with a religious discrimination bill unless it has bipartisan support. Now, this was an election promise, Phil, wasn't it, from Anthony Albanese to usher in protections against vilification for people of faith and at the same time protect LGBTQI teachers and students from discrimination by religious schools who currently have some exemptions under the Sex Discrimination Act. That was the change that Anthony Albanese promised during the election campaign. It was always going to be a tricky balancing act, but another broken promise is risky for the Prime Minister, isn't it? What's the political calculation here?
Well, there's several, Fran. I think, you know, starting with this isn't really bread and butter for Labor. This was really a coalition issue, and Albanese sort of got caught in it all, if you like, before the last election. It's a bit like his stage three tax cut promise. Yeah, we'll sort it after the election. And I think now's the time has come to confront it. As per your introduction, it's like walking on eggshells politically, you know, the sensitivities on both sides of this thing and the ability to strike the right balance. You're never going to please either side, probably. So, but by way of background, we sort of had this anger from Peter Dutton this week because Anthony Albanese told his caucus on Tuesday that he'd had a conversation with Dutton and had told him, look, I'm prepared to move ahead on this, but I need your support and I don't want to fight on it, and I'm only going to do it if there's bipartisan support. And Dutton came out, did a press conference quite angry, saying, oh, he's breached this private conversation. This wasn't supposed to be public. But there's a bit of theatrics to that because, as it turned out, the Prime Minister's office and Dutton's office held talks last week on this, preliminary talks, at a chief of staff level, as I understand. So it wasn't sort of out of the blue that Albo had breached this confidence. Clearly the Prime Minister knows he has to do something on this, knows he has to fulfil that promise, but wants it to be as painless and as uncontroversial as possible. Whether he can land it is another matter. It's not just getting agreement with the coalition. It's the coalition being able to agree with itself. And you can understand.
Well put.
Yeah, well, you can understand the push and pull between the moderates and the conservatives.
The opposition wasn't thrilled with the government's attempt to redirect the pressure on them because they were like, hang on a minute, I think we're getting tricked here. Here's what the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, had to say about the Prime Minister's approach.
What he wants to be able to do is to walk out of this process and say, oh, I gave it every good effort, but you know, unfortunately the coalition didn't support it on a bipartisan basis. Therefore, I'm running away from it. I'm not arguing for it. It's not our policy. So he's trying to find an out on a topic that he doesn't want to go anywhere near.
Now, Phil, my theory is that probably it's not in either of their interests to go anywhere near it, to be honest, but it is still a promise, and so they both need to be engaging with it. The big question is, was the government trying to wedge them? And I just want to say, at the start, it did look to me like a bit weird that the government was asking for bipartisanship without sharing the bill. Mm. They have now shared the bill with the opposition.
And there's a report out this afternoon, Thursday afternoon after question time, from the Law Reform Commission into all this as well, which will guide deliberations, as I understand. Look, I don't think they are trying to wedge, Patricia. I think Albanese is acutely aware he sort of got saddled with this. You know, he made this promise before the election to, you know, keep religious groups happy and so forth. If you remember, that was one of the demographics that was supportive of Scott Morrison because of Scott Morrison's religious leaning. So, you know, it was a sort of assurance to them from Albanese, and he's now sort of, it's delivery time. I genuinely believe he just wants to, if he has to do this, he wants to make it as seamless and painless as possible and have the opposition on side. I think that's probably his desire. I don't think he wants to be seen to be breaking a promise.
Well, that's true. I would contest that Anthony Albanese got saddled with it. I mean, Labor stood up and said, we will protect LGBTQI students and teachers to make sure they can no longer be discriminated against by religious schools. We will remove that element of the Sex Discrimination Act, and we also believe people of faith should have some protection. So they sort of walked into that. I don't know that they got saddled with it.
Yeah, well, poor choice of words. Yeah, walked into it.
But
inherited it. Yeah.
As the Prime Minister announced this, the backdrop he's saying is that, you know, we just do not want, at this time where social cohesion is an issue, given the tensions in our community around the Gaza war, and I've spoken to people in Cabinet too who said, look, we've had two divisive debates emanating from The Voice and now Gaza. We don't want to have another protracted, divisive debate. There were people are going to get hurt, vulnerable people, people are going to be hurt. So that was what they say genuinely is an issue. But I think the crunch comes, you know, cost of living. Basically, they're asking each other, if we're not talking about cost of living, then we need to be make sure we can get an outcome here, because any minute we're not talking about cost of living is a problem politically. So we can only afford to do that if we can actually land this thing.
Well, that's exactly right, Fran. I mean, yeah, as we know, the Prime Minister got a hiding from the voters late last year because, yeah, they felt he wasn't sufficiently focused on cost of living instead of The Voice. And to many people, religious freedom is a niche issue. It's important to people it affects directly, but to the broader population, it's not something that keeps them awake at night. They see it as a culture war thing, and Albanese will be conscious of that. Yeah, he's worked strenuously since Christmas to sort of heave the ship back right again and talk about nothing but cost of living. You know, the Stage 3 tax cut, broken promise, was a huge gesture towards middle Australia, that sort of thing. And I guess the last thing he wants to do is be dragged off that again on an issue which, you know, isn't central to most people's concerns.
He's right to want that, because I do think the community would just go, what? Again? It's been years, man.
I mean, this is the sort of culture war stuff that, you know, the coalition likes to get involved in. It's not really a Labor thing.
And the other problem he's kind of had on his hands, changing the topic, but we were talking earlier about the visit from the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, but also Paul Keating's been the disruptor this week on this former Prime Minister, not afraid to share his views.
He's not the only one causing trouble this week, former Prime Ministers. Look, though, it's dead right. In isolation, Patricia, Wang Yi's visit is hugely significant. He's the most senior Chinese politician or official to visit Australia since, I think, former Premier Li Keqiang came 7 years ago. And as was confirmed yesterday by Wang Yi, the new Premier Li will be coming to Australia later this year. So it is hugely important in terms of Labor's efforts to restore or stabilise the relationship, you know, notwithstanding the significant setbacks such as the death sentence on Yong Heng Jun and others. But Keating, I mean, it wasn't just this week. Remember, the ASEAN conference in Melbourne was at the week before last. I mean, completely out of order, where he came in over the top of that. You know, it was a big occasion for the Prime Minister and for Senator Wong to be hosting these foreign leaders. So it was incredibly rude and embarrassing, and they were very unhappy about it. And now, you know, for Paul Keating, you know, to accept the invitation to meet Wang Yi this week, again, I can tell you that the government is really unhappy about it, but they won't say that publicly, nor would they try to stop it happening. But again, it allows the Chinese to sort of, you know, send their own message on this visit, whereas we'd rather this visit's on our terms and, you know, with regard to the messages we want emanating from
it. Yeah, it's like they're playing us off against each other.
Yeah, they say, we'll go meet this guy who thinks differently to you and give it equal status. I like Paul Keating, but I'm sorry, but he's allowing himself to be used here, and it's not in the interest of the Labor government.
Well, you mentioned other prime ministers, and Phil, speaking of other prime ministers this week, Kevin Rudd got a bollocking from Donald Trump in a TV interview. To be clear, he was... It was the witness was led significantly in a TV interview with a former British firebrand politician who is now very much a broadcaster, Nigel Farage. Here is.
He has said the most horrible things. You were a destructive president, a traitor to the West, and he's now Australia's ambassador in Washington.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Would you take a phone call from him?
He won't be there long if that's the case. I don't know much about him. I heard he was a little bit nasty. I hear he's not the brightest bulb, but if he's at all hostile, he will not be there long.
Didn't even know he was. That's what I think. But
he clearly doesn't know him. Fancy anyone saying Kevin Rudd's not the brightest bulb.
That would annoy Rudd more than anything.
Exactly. You could fact check that. That's not right. But look, there he was. Australia had a meltdown. The opposition jumped on it. Peter Dutton insisting Kevin Rudd has to repair the relationship. Then the Nationals MP, Barnaby Joyce, said Kevin Rudd can't remain in the role. The Prime Minister is standing by Kevin Rudd. Penny Wong standing by him. You've written a controversial column about this. Really? Tell me, what's your take?
My take, Patricia, on this is, yeah, who cares? But the point is that when Trump was in power, like Joe Hockey turned out to be quite a successful ambassador because he had to ingratiate himself, like you wouldn't believe, into that White House because it was so nuts and so volatile. And you didn't know what they were going to do from one day to the next. And the alliance with Australia meant little. You know, you had to keep reminding them of that, pull every lever at your disposal to stop this happening. I remember we were in Hamburg at the G20. One year, and Trump was about to whack these tariffs on steel and aluminium, and Turnbull was Prime Minister, and Matthias Cormann was with him, and they had a meeting with Trump and his then Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and had to sort of basically beg them not to do it, and Hockey had come over for that and helped facilitate that. So this is the sort of, again, this is the sort of access you're going to need on a constant basis, and the problem is that if he doesn't want like Rudd and he doesn't want to let him through the front door, then we do have a problem.
But we don't have it yet.
No,
because it's 8 months away.
No,
so is the coalition right to politicise it then?
Well, I heard the Prime Minister say, how dare you politicise a diplomatic appointment, as if that's never been done.
We're getting there too early. That's one thing, we're overreacting. But also, Trump's a chameleon, so he shifts around a lot.
He is, friend.
They might be best friends in a couple of months.
Well, they might be, but we don't know. And no one's saying, you know, Rudd's got to come home now, but he may have to come home. If Trump wins and we can't get into the White House, then we may have to replace him.
I think it's worth pointing out, though, that by all accounts, Rudd has been doing a good job over there with both sides of politics. Not just according to Rudd. I've spoken to people who have said that a lot of Republicans are inviting him in because they want to hear his views on the China relationship.
That's true. But I also I'm not disputing anything you're saying, but what I'm saying is this could be a problem if Trump wins the election. That's all, and that's all my controversial piece said.
But it's a good talking point.
We're talking about it. Don't forget, 6 weeks ago, Steve Bannon, who's Rudd's, you know, who was Trump's Svengali, and is still wired into that whole scene over there. He told Sky News back then, you know, we don't like this Rudd fellow, and we're very sort of, you know, suspicious of his, and the words he used was to worm his way back into our favour was the term he used. He said, we've got this guy's number marked, right? So this wasn't, you know, this wasn't just sort of Trump on the fly. They are aware of Rudd and what he's written. And my broader point is that Rudd, his whole career, whether it's as Prime Minister or in the private sector, has always been indiscreet. I don't think he's ever conducted himself with the dignity that his office or his former office has required. And he would be on Facebook nearly every single day. And whether it was Morrison or Trump or someone else he didn't like. And these things have consequences. If you want to be a diplomat, this stuff will matter in the future. And I just, you know, don't forget, you know, when you say the opposition jumped on this, they're jumping on it because they want to make it about the Prime Minister's judgment for sending him there, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about Rudd. And don't forget, Penny Wong, Tony Burke, you're to get no people closer to Anthony Albanese, he said, don't send him, right? This was a pure captain's call. There was a lot of trepidation.
And there was a delay even after Synodinus was extended.
A lot of trepidation about Rudd going to the US because of his ability to, you know, track controversy and because of his indiscretions and because of the things he had said in the past. So it's a topic worth discussion, but ultimately, is it a problem? We'll know in, you know, 8 or 9 months.
Maybe later. Now, I just want to put something else on your radar, changing the topic again. That's Thursday morning we're recording this, and it's just emerging, but there might be a deal or something on Julian Assange that's emerging.
Well, look, there's a bit around. I don't have any detail, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, the Prime Minister's been pushing very hard on this for a long time and made no secret about it, and he raised it every time he talks to Biden and our ministers, every time they talk to the US counterpart. So, you know, it's sort of high time. I don't know what it'll be.
The government's reportedly considering a plea deal.
But... yes, which is what we saw, remember, with David Hicks, right?
That's right. So, that's why I asked you, because that's when I met you all those years ago, Phil Currie, and you were obsessed with Hicks.
I was, because it was a good story, and I followed it from Adelaide to New York and back to Canberra. Well, Hicks was a bit different, an unprecedented situation. But ultimately, you know, Hicks had been held in Guantanamo for 7 years, and it was very similar to Assange. Look, love him or hate him, whether he's done something or not enough is enough. You know, he's paid a price. He's been incarcerated for a long time. So with Hicks, Howard and Bush did a deal where he would plead guilty to this sort of invented, you know, this concocted charge they just made up. And then he immediately, they brought him home and he sat in an Adelaide jail until, you know, lo and behold, the day after the federal election, and they let him out. And then subsequently, actually, Hicks had the whole thing quashed because the charging retrospectively was something and you couldn't do it. They made the charge up after the crime. So he actually was never found guilty of anything, Hicks. So it's a similar
And that reflected
sort of,
well, my recollection of that is that reflected well on John Howard, that he did that he spoke to Bush and said, we want this guy back. And, you know, it would perhaps have the same... dividend for Anthony Albanese.
Well, absolutely. But I think with Howard, though, like, I mean, he initially, you know, he rode the politics of Hicks, remember?
Yeah.
It was a political problem. I think with Assange and Albanese, I think he's been polarising since the get-go, you know, whether you support him or you don't. But I think it's just a matter of principle.
Matter of time, too, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, are you really going to chuck him in the can for life in the US? I mean, the guy's had a pretty rugged time and whatever he did or didn't do. You know,
certainly
it's
done a lot of time
enough.
Already. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Just very briefly, but we mentioned the name earlier, Liberal Senator Alex Antic getting basically rolling Liberal and Rustin for the number ones for the South Australian Senate spot. To be clear, Anne Rustin in number two still gets in with a quota. They're not worried about her getting into the parliament. But Antic is well-known conservative. Trumpian is how he's described. Anti-vaccine stances, anti-woke agendas.
He's a backbencher
going
too.
Down?
He's a backbencher.
Yeah. Well, no, it's terrible. I mean, it's a terrible look. This is just a clear-cut case of what's going wrong with the Liberal Party elsewhere, you know, Victoria and Western Australia, where these hard-right elements have taken over the party. They're driving out not just moderates, but sort of, you know, sensible conservatives, if you like, and they're stacking the branches with some people with some fairly extreme views, and they can't see beyond their own immediate self-interest. You know, we see what Moira Deeming sort of doing to efforts by John Pesutto to try and salvage that party. And Alex is very similar in South Aussie. And, you know, this has been coming for a long time. They were going to throw Anne Rustin off the ticket altogether or put her in an unwinnable spot. And it was only through, you know, Dutton and others and Simon Birmingham behind the scenes, you know, twisting arms, you know, that they, you know, in their good grace, saved her and gave her number two. But, you know, where you and I sit and, you know, and Percy Punter, you've got to... Not just a woman, but she's a member of the shadow cabinet. She's a member of the leadership team, and she's been put second to someone no one's ever heard of, right? And it's just such a bad look on so many fronts, especially with a party that needs to reconnect with moderates and needs to reconnect with women. And it's just awful. But it got really bad at one stage. The mods were telling me back home that if they'd boned Anne, the party would have split like it split in the early 70s. You know, when Steele Hall walked away with what formed this thing called the Liberal Movement. He split from the Conservatives back then, and that took several years to heal. So it's not a good thing, and there's a lot of people back in Adelaide are really worried about the direction of the Liberal Party now, because Antic's faction sort of is firmly in control of all its machinery.
Yeah, as one of those moderates, like one person told me, 19 delegates out of 210 changed their vote, and Anne would have lost the second spot to a rank outsider.
Yeah, and it's no reflection on Dutton, because he's actually, you know, you can't, it's not like the Labor Party where the leader can just say, I want this person, and it gets done by the National
Don't forget,
executive.
The Labor Party nearly did it with Penny Wong.
This was the great comparison.
Was knocking her off on number one.
Don's a factional guy, plays as hard as anyone has ever known, but he always puts the party first, right? He always puts the good of the Labor Party first and its electoral prospect. Whereas what's going on in the Liberal Party, that stuff is secondary, you know, it's all about, you know, me and my interests, and this is why it gets damaging.
Oh, Phil, it's good to know you're still so plugged in there in South Australian politics.
Me.
Phil Currie, thanks for being with
us
on the Party Room. It's been great.
Thank you, Phil.
Good on you, guys. See
ya.
We'll move to questions without notice. We'll give the call to the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
Order.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. This week's question comes from Janet, who has a question about Fran's favourite subject, housing.
Hi, Fran and PK. In Sydney, there are more voters aged 18 to 25 living with their parents in formerly safe seats than there were 30 years ago. Could you ask an election analyst to comment on the impact of this expanding block of Gen Z voters who remain living in their parents' homes in many electorates?
Janet, good point. And I think I, even without asking an election analyst, I can say that...
But you're an election analyst.
Well, yeah, okay. But I think she was thinking more, you know, someone a bit more sort of focused and
like
targeted
Anthony
than
Green.
Me. Maybe, yeah. Janet, I'm not sure about the extent of this block. Clearly things are changing and we saw the impact of a changing demographic in some other wealthy electorates. For instance, when the Teals got elected in some of those blue ribbon seats like Kooyong, like Wentworth, like Goldstein... And we saw the change there because the demographic of those seats have changed. It's not necessarily and not so much kids staying at home in their parents' big houses changing the nature of those electorates. It's the fact that there's a lot of infill building going in. So there's a lot of apartments being built. There's a lot of renters there, which means a younger demographic generally. And that's what changed the nature of those seats. So would this demographic change, the fact that kids are living at home till they're 30, is this going to be enough to make a difference? It would make some difference. I don't know if it would be definitive. But it's a good point to raise.
It's an interesting point, but I also just want to make a point about voting habits. Yes, in a seat like Kooyong, a lot of renters there, and I think that's one of the reasons that Josh Frydenberg, you know, lost that seat. But if you see, and I've spoke to her about it too, Zoe Daniels' army of volunteers in her seat, there was a lot of grey. So I think the idea that boomers all have one view and Gen Z all have another view is a really misunderstood idea. A lot of the shifts that happened in those seats were also older people.
Yeah, that's true.
So I just think that's also part of the story. Do young people, are they more progressively voting? It's a fact. All of the demographic trends show that they are, but there's also much more diversity in that boomer vote than I think is clearly understood.
Good point, PK, and good question, Janet. Thank you.
Yeah, Janet, a very good question. Send your questions in. We love getting them. We're especially fond of your voice notes. And next week is our kind of special, you know, big Easter episode so that if you go on a road trip on Good Friday, you can listen to it. So send your voice questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. And I want to say, please rate and review us. It really helps the podcast get known about.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to the bumper Easter episode. Can't wait for that. But a big shout out to, before we go, for the winners of the MacKinnon Prize for Outstanding Political Leadership. It's an annual non-partisan independent prize. And I think it's worth noting that it was handed out to two people. It was shared this year, the MacKinnon Prize. Bridget Archer, Liberal MP, of course, from Tasmania, and independent ACT Senator David Pocock. So they're the winners of the MacKinnon Prize, which is, you know, getting to be quite a big deal, really, that prize.
Yeah, they congratulations to both of them. That's it for the podcast this week. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.